Hey there. Did you know Kroger always gives you savings and rewards on top of our lower than low prices? And when you download the Kroger app, you'll enjoy over $500 in savings every week with digital coupons. And don't forget fuel points to help you save up to $1 per gallon at the pump. Want to save even more? With a Boost membership, you'll get double fuel points and free delivery. So shop and save big at Kroger today. Kroger, fresh for everyone. Savings may vary by state. Restrictions apply. See site for details.
What kind of a show are you guys putting on here today?
You're not interested in art?
No.
Now look, we're going to do this thing. We're going to have a conversation.
From Chicago, this is Film Spotting. I'm Adam Kempinar.
And I'm Josh Larson. Sure want to thank you for coming all the way up here to see me from that nice hotel downtown.
No problem. What's on your mind?
Well now, here's a man who wants to get right down to it. Kind of anxious to get to it, are you?
Anxious to talk about the depraved, delusional, psychotic, and just plain creepy men and women who populate the David Lynch universe? As the man himself might say, sounds peachy keen. This week, we debut Blindspotting with a review of Lynch's 1977 debut, Eraserhead, and share our top five David Lynch scenes.
Plus a review of The Skeleton Twins with SNL alums Kristen Wiig and Bill Hader. That and more.
Josh, I'm sorry, I don't want to go to Winkies after this and hear about your nightmare.
Head on Film Spotting.
She wore blue. Bluer than velvet was the night.
This episode of Film Spotting is brought to you by Shutterstock.com. With over 1.9 million high-quality video clips, Shutterstock helps you take your creative projects to the next level. To start a new account and take 20% off only footage clips, go to Shutterstock.com and use offer code FILM914.
We're also brought to you by Harry's. Very pleased to have Harry's back on board as a sponsor of Film Spotting. Josh, I see that despite my previous entreaties, all of the kind things I have said about Harry's and the great shave I get with their razors, you still are rocking the 5 o'clock shadow thing.
I'm thinking about it, though.
Thinking about it?
Yeah. You've got me thinking about it. Let's see. Well, let's see if you can sell me.
Harry's really has been a revelation for me as someone who, as I've said before, has to shave every day. The best thing about it, Josh, it's the price, of course, about half the price of other big razor blade brands. But what I really love is the fact that they ship for free to my front door. I know that every 2 months, I'm going to get another set of 8 razor blades in the mail, never have to run out to the store late at night or early in the morning to pick up some razor blades. I really do love the look and feel of the set I have, which is the Winston Engrave set, and it does give me a great shave for a great price.
Not bad. Might have to try it. For a clean, close, comfortable shave, go to harrys.com. That's harrys.com. Use the offer code FILMSPOTTING to get $5 off your first purchase. That's harrys.com, promo code FILMSPOTTING. We thank Harry's for their support of the show.
You're listening to Film Spotting, where it's sociopath night at the Film Spotting Lounge, half off Pabst Blue Ribbons and nitrous oxide chasers. It should put us in the right frame of mind for our top five David Lynch scenes. That's later in the show.
I was wondering why we were recording in a dentist's office. Makes sense now. First, a review of a movie that I thankfully had not seen before I had kids, because it would take a brave soul to have a baby after they've watched David Lynch's Eraserhead.
Mary usually does the carving, but maybe tonight you'll do it, Henry. All right with you?
Of course. I'd be happy to. Do I just cut them up like regular chickens?
Sure, just cut them up like regular chickens.
So a new segment here on Film Spotting. Hopefully it will be a recurring one. Blind Spotting. Basically, a sacred cow review meets a marathon. One movie, not a whole series, and instead of discussing a film we've seen at least once and want to revisit, we take a look at a revered movie we've always been a little embarrassed to admit we've never seen. The impetus for Eraserhead? Just this week, the Criterion Collection released a Blu-ray edition of David Lynch's 1977 feature debut. The disc includes a new 4K digital restoration supervised by Lynch, and I watched that, Josh, so I can vouch for it and say it's stunning. Eraserhead Stories, a 2001 documentary by Lynch on the making of the film, a process that took somewhere between 4 and 7 years to complete, depending on what story you read. I'm not an expert on Lynch's upbringing, but I do know that he was born and raised in Missoula, Montana. And at some point before moving to L.A. to pursue filmmaking at AFI, he spent time in Philadelphia. The city of brotherly love apparently had a profound effect on him. In the book Lynch on Lynch, the director tells Chris Rodley this about the world of Eraserhead. It's a world that's neither here nor there. It came out of the air in Philadelphia. I always say it's my Philadelphia story. It just doesn't have Jimmy Stewart in it. Lynch has a pretty notorious ironic streak, and it's tempting to interpret that quote accordingly and laugh, but if you really break down the plot of Eraserhead, Josh, we must take Lynch's quip at face value. After all, what classic Hollywood romantic comedy doesn't go something like this? Boy has already met girl. Boy impregnates girl. Girl has baby. Boy marries and moves in with girl. Baby turns out to be a grotesque creature with a serpentine face that cries all night. Girl leaves boy. Boy is stuck with baby. And finally, boy has visions or something involving characters we can only refer to as the man in the planet and the lady in the radiator. And I want to be clear, the lady, she lives in the radiator, where she also performs on a stage inside the radiator.
I've seen that a million times.
Yeah, if you've seen one, you've seen them all by now, Josh. Jokes aside, this is a truly bizarre little movie, even by Lynchian standards. What were you able to grasp onto, if anything? And did going back to Lynch's filmmaking beginnings give you any further insight into his work? Did it teach you something new?
Boy, I was able to grasp onto more here probably than his last three or four films.
Really?
Yeah. But to answer your other question about what did it reveal, that's the tougher question. And I think for me, it's related to the difference between this work and his later films. It revealed to me that his puzzle boxes are deeply personal, because you always got that sense in something like Mulholland Drive or even Inland Empire that this is clearly about something to him. We may never figure it out. Mm-hmm. We may get intimations. We may see what the illusions are or the subconscious elements that are at play. But it's not always as clear. Part of it is the puzzle. This isn't really a puzzle film. And the effect for me is that it felt that much closer to a subconscious I could relate to, a subconscious I could understand and apply to some of my own experiences or own fears or desires. And in that way, I think Eraserhead is his most alive film. And I really responded to it in that it was a visceral impact film for me. It disturbed me in a way that none of his other movies have, even though many of them have very disturbing elements, violent elements, mm-hmm. things that you recoil from. This one really got under the skin and ate away at things in a unique manner. And I think it's because it was less of that puzzle and more of just a burst of subconscious.
That's really fascinating, because I don't know that I would ever say to anyone that I think this movie is less of a puzzle than something like Inland Empire or Lost Highway, but I do take your point about it being even more of sort of a subconscious fever dream than those films, which do have more plot to them, even if the plot is completely abstract and somewhat nonsensical. So I do see what you're saying there. For me, this movie was a revelation as well, in the sense that I noticed a couple things, and I'm sure we could spend all this discussion highlighting things that seem very familiar. There were at least two things that stood out, a few elements where you realize, okay, they were just part of his imagination from the get-go. And I think that is the fun of seeing his other films and going back to this one at the beginning. You recognize that there are certain themes or motifs that are on display here that run throughout his work. And a third, it actually took, for me, Josh, seeing Eraserhead to realize that it was a through line in his work. I had never put it together before. I know we'll certainly get to that, but most obviously, Lynch's favoring of the abstract over the literal. Not that there aren't literal elements here, but this idea that life is a dream slash nightmare, it unfolds, as you said, viscerally, also visually, utilizing the camera, how it's placed, how it doesn't move really for the most part, or when it does, it sort of just glides. The editing, the sound in particular, to convey meaning, to convey mood. There is a constant sound to the silence in this movie that I don't think we get from many filmmakers other than Lynch. It really does make you realize that there's never really silence in our everyday life. There's always some kind of a hum or a howl. And Lynch is focusing our senses as viewers. He makes us hear things we usually don't hear and see the types of things that we only typically hear or hear about but don't see in Blue Velvet. One of my favorite David Lynch movies, maybe my favorite David Lynch movie, is a movie that's all about that. There's that epiphany kind of moment where Jeffrey says to Sandy, it's a strange world. What really gets at all of that activity, that unseen activity, though, gets at the other obvious Lynch motif for me that you certainly see on display here in Eraserhead. Who's pulling the strings? What are these forces? It's usually dark forces in his films that seem to be in control of everything. Think about the man on the phone in Mulholland Drive, those Italian men who insist the director cast a certain girl, the mysterious cowboy. Twin Peaks certainly explores it. You've got a character called the man from another place in The Red Room. Wild at Heart, we can go down the line. Lost Highway. In Eraserhead, there's literally a man, as I said, from another planet. That's how we really have to refer to him. That's how he's listed in the credits. Who's pushing and pulling levers, implying, I think, that this character, Jack Nance, who plays Henry, is his name, the one character other than Mary X, if you want to call that a normal name, his wife, his name's Henry Spencer. And that does sort of suggest that this whole world may be a machine of some sort. It's a construct that this character is in charge of. Even with Lynch, you get throughout his films sort of those moments where there's glitches in electricity. Things just sort of seem to be failing as if there's a construct at work here, all these forces at work, and yet there are these little moments where things just don't go the way they should go that cue you into that fact. So there are those elements, certainly, as I said, motifs or conventions, the way he approaches film that you see in Eraserhead going back to the very beginning.
Yeah, The Man in the Moon is interesting. You're right. This is actually a puzzle movie because he initiates the action to some extent, and it isn't always entirely clear. For me, maybe it's that the fact that it doesn't have as much plot as Mulholland Drive or some of those others seems to free it a little bit. But it's, as you describe it, it's probably as much of a puzzle movie as any of the others. I like how you're mentioning all these formal elements that Lynch exhibits here. His control over them is what's so impressive to me from a debut feature. The editing, the cinematography, and the sound design. So glad you mentioned that. And I like how you describe the ambient noise that's there when it should be silence, because that's very true and very disturbing, very unnerving, because we're not used to that in a film. And I think about some of the other examples that we're just always hearing something that's often taking place off screen. And the reveal, the one that comes to mind is the gnawing or the chewing that we hear. And then the reveal is that it's puppies nursing at their mother. And there's just something about that reversal Lynch pulls in that the noise we hear is disturbing, but what we see is not. And he gives us the noise first and then gives us the image and
defies our expectations.
Defies our expectations and somehow makes the comforting and the wholesome truly troubling. And just doing that largely by sound design.
Yeah.
So there's so much of that. And how about that cry of this worm baby? I mean, there's a beautiful word for that, mewling. I mean, I think mewling was invented just for this creature.
That creature might be part mule.
I don't know what it is. But the crazy thing about it is the sound is also so similar to an infant that you'd have down the hall. And this is why
I was having flashbacks.
This is why I say I'm so glad I saw this after I had kids, because I wouldn't want to hear that sound coming from my hall. And you do sometimes when you have a young child in the house think, what am I living with when it's the middle of the night and you haven't slept for a few days in a row? And so just the bravery of, you know, not only addressing that. And again, I don't know how one-to-one we want to make these to Lynch's own experience, but it's obviously a touchstone. And the bravery of not only addressing that, but making it, just going 20 levels more in the disturbing nature of it, is something that just kind of blows my mind.
You're listening to Film Spotting. We're discussing David Lynch's 1977 film, Eraserhead. It is out now in a special Criterion Collection Blu-ray. And Josh, that's a perfect transition into my third point, the one I said that was something before Eraserhead I never would have thought of in relation to Lynch. You could have given me 10 or 20 words to sum up David Lynch and his movies, or phrases, and it's doubtful that I ever would have hit on before seeing Eraserhead: domesticity or family. Never thought of that in relation to Lynch. And now looking back on it, I feel like an idiot because I actually put this movie as a horror film, which I think we can call it that. And it certainly gained its notoriety and made some money on that horror circuit in the midnight movies, especially in the later 70s and the 80s. But I put this movie with something like The Shining, which we talked about, and The Evil Dead, which for me are these movies that have this undercurrent, textual in some ways, subtextual in others, about these characters and this fear of commitment or the fear of losing their individuality, their artistic drive, whatever it may be, because they're sublimating that for a wife and for a child. And it's pretty hard not to see that baby here, if we can call it that, as a representation of those types of fears. It traps this Henry character and almost literally paralyzes him. He mostly just sits there and looks, which gets back to what I was saying about Lynch forcing us to kind of open up our senses and really dial into them. I think that's partly because we're looking at him looking at the world so intently. He's so focused on everything he's seeing and trying to dissect it that we do that as well. But that sense of struggling with this notion of the domestic, the most disturbing part of it for me, as you said, I can relate on the baby stuff. There are moments that you can go back to as a parent with a young child, no matter how good you think you are as a parent, no matter how good you think your baby really is, there are going to be a few nights where the baby just won't stop crying, or where the baby, at least for 2 or 3 hours, is just going to be upset and might be having some kind of night terror or whatever, and you can't solve it. And that is a really overwhelming feeling, and we get that here. But what Lynch really does, I think, that's most interesting is the way he compresses time, the way it just folds in on itself. That's what really makes it so troubling, because there is no real sense of the passing of time. We see the woman across the hall at the beginning of the film. I think her name is the beautiful woman across the hall. Yes. That's how we're supposed to refer to her. And he comes back to his place and she says, oh, your girlfriend invited you to dinner. Now, I watched this movie late at night and it's a weird movie. And so it's entirely possible that my own brain was compressing time. But I'm going to give Lynch the credit for it. There's a sense from the way she says that, your girlfriend's invited you over, you go to this dinner scene. Mm-hmm. It's almost as if maybe he's meeting them for the first time. They seem to be making it a little bit more ceremonial than I think you would if it was just, oh, Henry's come over for dinner.
Right, right.
And so we go from this sense that it could be that, the sense that it could be that, this trip over to meet the family, to discovering that she's pregnant. And then they're living together. They're raising this baby and they're married. So there's that lack of control again. There's no sense of easy progression of choices that were made. It's as if he
you
didn't
get the
have
sense
any
it's the
sense.
Next day, right?
Yeah, it's the next day. Yeah. This just all happened right. Almost overnight. And in his psyche, maybe it did. He went from dinner with the family to being married and raising an incessantly needy baby. And I think, again, talk about a fear, just an overwhelming sense of fear. It's all captured in the way Lynch presents time.
Well, the folding in of time also makes me think there's the sense that she's pregnant before he even met her.
Right.
In one way, if that's what you're talking about,
that
the dinner scene.
Saying,
because,
yeah.
And that would make sense with another fear that's going on here. And that's about sexuality itself.
Yeah.
I mean, there's just a panic and a recoiling on the part of Henry Spencer whenever the topic comes up, even with the beautiful woman across the hall who he looks at in that manner, but it also frightens him and disturbs him. He goes for that dinner and Mary X's mother comes on to him and he's just absolutely perplexed in that scene as well. So I think one of those other undercurrents here related to domesticity, I think, is this fear of sex, or maybe it's more a fear of what sex will lead to.
Yeah.
And so that's where it all does come together. And I think that, you know, Jack Nance's performance is really crucial to a lot of this, even though everyone's familiar with his dazed look and the hair, right? He has such a look that it's easy to just consider that's all he's bringing to it. But he's a straight man in this film for a lot of the – we should talk about how slyly funny it is.
I would love to.
And
yeah.
He is the straight man for all of those jokes, and I think he pulls it out just beautifully with that same expression, because you can't have anyone go – too far in any direction to the absurdities going on here. You need just someone, like you said, to just look at it and not know what to do with it.
Yeah.
Because then we don't get any help.
Right.
We've got to deal with it.
Yeah. And I'll give you my favorite funny moment for me in the entire film. And it still cuts to the heart of the fear of the family as well. It's when Mary X finally says, I've had it.
Uh-huh.
I'm going to sleep at my parents' house. I just need a good night's sleep. And then you see her, and it's from Jack Nance's point of view, reach under the bed. And you really have no idea what she's doing, but the way it's shot, you only see her head above the bed frame and just a ruckus underneath the bed, like almost as if she's trying to pick up the bed. And you are watching, as his character is, just thinking, what is she after? What crazy Lynch thing is this moment now where she's so trying to disrupt him that she's going to do something to the bed? And then you finally realize she pulls out a suitcase.
Uh-huh.
That whole time she was just struggling to get a suitcase. And again, I do love it because it's literal baggage and it's metaphoric baggage as well. She says, I'm taking that out from under the bed and I am out of here.
And again, he's undercutting your expectations, which what's really remarkable about this is that it's almost as if he's reacting to the reputation he would go on to have.
Yeah.
So we've got this small independent film. No one knows that this is a guy who's going to create atmospheres where anything can happen at any time. But already he's using that suitcase scene to build on our expectation that something weird mm-hmm. is going to happen. And then he deflates it. And so he kind of keeps us in that tension throughout the film. And the humor does that as well. Things never get so preposterous. Well, let me put it this way, because they get preposterous, but they don't get that way in a pretentious manner. It seems that whenever there is the oddest image, it's always either preceded by a sly visual joke or followed by a sly visual joke, so that these odd things don't have this heavy weight to them.
Yeah.
That for as disturbing as they are, they're also light and mm-hmm. airy in a way. And that that just makes it seem like it's not some overbearing art film.
I agree completely, and I think I would be remiss if I didn't at least give a little bit of backup to my claim that this fear of the family or the dissolution of a family or the coming together in some ways and the fallout you can have from that. If I didn't mention that in relation to some of his other films, because as I said, I didn't really think of it as a David Lynch thing before Eraserhead, but jumping ahead a little bit to our top five David Lynch scenes, how about a scene like The Elephant Man, where you have John Merrick talking to John Gielgud and to Anthony Hopkins, the doctor, and them telling him that he lives here now. And he mm-hmm. says, this is my home?
Yeah.
Incredulously, he just can't believe that this is now his home. And think about the tragic end scene of The Elephant Man and what he's fighting with there. Blue Velvet is a movie about a family unit that's torn apart by these David Lynch dark forces in the form of Dennis Hopper's Frank, but also Jeffrey and Sandy, the Laura Dern character, and Kyle MacLachlan. They represent this idealistic stereotype of the American teenager. He's back at home because he's helping out his dad at the hardware store they own. She helps her dad, just a good girl, but they get sucked into Dorothy's nightmare. They suck themselves in because they can't stop their curiosity, this thirst for knowledge of observing, like Jack Nance. They keep seeing and hearing things that they were previously unaware of. Wild at Heart. Actually, another movie about a family torn apart by sinister forces, Lula's father. And we learn some of the secrets behind that. And the ultimate question to that film is whether or not Lula and Sailor's love is going to survive in this crazy world and whether or not they can bring a child into it. So it's all over. The Straight Story, a movie about a character who had his shot at domestic life and threw it away, and about reconnecting with his brother. Twin Peaks, of course, very much about the dissolution of a family. Lost Highway, the dissolution of a marriage. Inland Empire, the dissolution of my mind, among with maybe other things. But I think no matter how you frame it, it's not even so much can I be a father or can I be a good father that you see in Eraserhead and some of his other films, but this idea Lynch seems to want to wrestle with about whether these kind of individual impulses can be tamed when you're now part of another group, when you're part of a collective. Is there a fracture there? And often we see that fracture very literally in terms of doppelgangers in his work.
And there's a lot of social anxiety, right? And here that anxiety is translated into this really jarring imagery. So certainly a ton of thematic motifs pop up already in Eraserhead that we will see throughout his career. Visual motifs as well, though. That already we have someone performing in a spotlight for an audience.
Throughout all those films I mentioned, there are those moments.
And that seems, you know, that can be a social anxiety thing, too. Everyone's looking at you. But more often, it's about the person in the audience, what they're watching and what that's making them feel, how it's making them feel dislocated.
You're previewing our top five list,
aren't
you?
We probably shouldn't get into too many of these. But the other one I did think about, and this is related to the spotlight scene in Eraserhead, who's performing there is this woman who's disfigured in some way. And of course, that's the central idea of the Elephant Man. And that's just another thing that you can see, even a little bit of a touch. I mean, obviously, the child itself, you could say, is disfigured, but something that he'll keep returning to. So a real Fountainhead film, I think, is what you can call Eraserhead. And to my mind, probably his masterpiece, though.
Wow.
I haven't seen Dune.
I love that you had that strong of a reaction to this film, and very funny. Speaking of undercutting with the humor, you mentioned Dune with a very deadpan face there, Josh. That was impressive. But I just love some of his other films so much. I can't go there with Eraserhead. But I do want to mention the darkness as well in this film. The black and white, Herb Caldwell, I believe,
Have we even mentioned it's in black and white?
I think I did.
Okay.
Maybe in the setup, but actually, I don't know.
Because it's so crucial.
I was going to say it's beautiful, and it is. I said the transfer is stunning, but it's so dark. It's really black.
Mm-hmm.
Obviously, very much by design here, and it does remind me a little bit, though obviously I'm jumping ahead to right now. I'm watching Steven Soderbergh's The Nick on Showtime. Takes place turn of the century, New York City. Electricity is just coming about, and most of the rooms, everything is still lit by candlelight. And Soderbergh being Soderbergh, he's really experimenting with how dark can I make a scene and still give the viewer something to look at. I mean, you think The Godfather, famously Gordon Willis and all the lore about how dark they made it, and the studio saw the dailies and said, no, you can't do that. Okay, this is The Godfather, but three times as dark.
Huh.
Because you really see the Nick, and there are times where you're really straining to see what you're looking at. And it works in the Nick, I think, because it reflects the times themselves. Obviously, these characters would be straining that hard. But also, I think it does metaphorically represent the lack of clarity morally in every character's actions in that series. Well, that same darkness permeates Eraserhead. But going back to what I was saying about the senses and Lynch, I think it really does just force you to, as the Henry character is trying to do, to try to make sense of this world, to try to make sense of who he is and what's going on around him. And that darkness, it just makes you focus in and hone in on everything that's happening in that room. Are your eyes really deceiving you or not?
And the high contrast that the black and white cinematography provides, you mentioned ambient noise. It's almost as if that allows for ambient air. I think of the many scenes where there's some sort of dust or the light is filtered in a certain way where you can sense that there's a material in the air that's just makes things off. Why is it unclean in that way? It's just every detail in this film seems designed to make you uncomfortable.
It's industrialization, Josh.
Okay.
Eraserhead was just released in a special Criterion Collection Blu-ray. As we mentioned, it's out now. It's also available, my notes say, via Nightmare. So, I don't know, maybe don't eat something spicy before going to bed after you see Eraserhead. Send us your thoughts on the film and your nightmares. Always fascinating to hear about people's dreams. Feedback at filmspotting.net.
Even more nightmares are ahead when Adam and I play Massacre Theater. Then we'll review The Skeleton Twins, in which Kristen Wiig and Bill Hader also happen to indulge in some nitrous oxide.
Pass me the mask, Josh.
Stay with us. Interruption here to remind you that this episode of Film Spotting is brought to you by Harry's. For guys like you who want a great shave experience for a fraction of what you're paying now, go to harrys.com and get $5 off your first purchase by entering the code FilmSpotting when you check out.
We're also brought to you by Shutterstock.com, where you'll find the perfect video for your next creative project. And inspired by David Lynch and Eraserhead, Josh, you went to Shutterstock.com to see what footage might come up. We typed in surrealism,
yeah,
thinking of Lynch and his work, 120,558 results related to surrealism. Now, we thought we'd have a little bit of fun. We were positive it would come up with zero. We typed in Creature Baby. What did Creature Baby give us?
16,938 results.
Wow.
Many of which appear to be monkey babies and some wallpaper for nurseries with creatures on it.
Do
like friendly creatures.
So there's not Eraserhead nursery wallpaper? Would
no,
you buy that?
I don't see that. I don't see any mewling alien babies.
That would be troubling. Why didn't you type in alien babies? Type that in, Josh. Come on.
All right, let me see what
we got. The magic of the internet while we do a promo for our sponsor. Josh will now type in alien babies.
Thanks for drawing that out. We have even less.
Oh, no.
1,735. One guy is showing up here twice. There's a creature baby who's also an alien baby.
That makes sense.
Versatile.
You can get some crossover there. You can choose from over 1.9 million high-quality stock video clips, 2D animations, and 3D motion graphics if you use Shutterstock. And they do have clips in a variety of digital formats, from low resolution for web use to HD, and now some in 4K. And we do like to remind you that many of their contributors are professional filmmakers. They add over 20,000 video clips each week. Every time you visit, you'll find something new, and they've got flexible pricing. Just need one clip of an alien baby? You can get it. Maybe you need a whole pack of alien baby clips. You can get that as well.
The best one here is probably this recreation of the alien from Alien, the one that bursts out of the chest. You know,
love it.
That was a baby.
That was indeed.
You can try Shutterstock today by signing up for a free account. No credit card is needed. Just start an account and begin browsing Shutterstock to help imagine what your next project could be like. Save your video selections that you find to your clip box. Once you decide to purchase, use offer code FILM914 and new accounts will receive 20% off only footage clips. That's Shutterstock.com, and for 20% off any video clips with a new account, use offer code FILM914. We thank Shutterstock for their support.
Do you think David Lynch contributes to Shutterstock?
Oh, I'm positive.
Film Spotting is supported by the 50th Chicago International Film Festival and the Illinois Office of Tourism, dedicated to introducing audiences to new filmmakers, new stories, and new perspectives. Featuring more than 200 films from over 50 countries, October 9th through 23rd at AMC River East 21. Tickets and film schedule at chicagofilmfestival.com. The Chicago International Film Festival, because everybody loves movies. Illinois. Mile after magnificent mile.
You're not in your hut. What are you doing here?
Mopping up.
And you?
Shower. I need a wash.
I'm watching him. I'm a lifeguard.
Bounce!
John Layton as Willie Tunnel King Dix, Charles Bronson as Danny Tunnel King Valinsky, and James Coburn as Lewis Manufacturer Sedgwick in 1963's The Great Escape. Welcome back to Film Spotting with Josh Larson. I'm Adam Kempinar.
Wait a minute. James Coburn? I thought it was Lee Marvin in The Great Escape.
Which brings us to yet another Film Spotting segment. Where's our listener, Joran Kane? When you need him, we need a theme song for Film Spotting Corrections.
Oh, boy.
It is true that last week on the show, during our top five list of our favorite movie prisoners, I did regrettably refer to James Coburn as Lee Marvin. Lee Marvin couldn't play an Australian. That's James Coburn range. Okay, Josh, how dare I?
I didn't catch you either, so it's also
didn't.
My fault.
No.
But do we make that many mistakes that we need a theme song?
Well, probably.
I hope not.
But I guess it's been a while since we've highlighted one on the show. Got some feedback from that. And this is what I will say in my defense. I Googled Lee Marvin, James Coburn confusion or something like that, and you'll find it on Google. People on
it's
different
common.
Websites saying, yeah, I always mix those two guys up. So I guess I did in my head, but I'm not the only one who makes that mistake. There are actors, aren't there, or actresses that you do that with as well?
Oh, yeah. Yeah, all the time.
Okay. Thanks so, for defending
okay.
me. Yeah. Thanks for having
me. Next time I'll try
there,
to
Josh.
Catch your mistake and point it out to
That would
you
be nice,
ahead
too.
Of time.
We
that would probably
cut
work
it out
better.
Before I look like a moron when we share that with the public. Over at our website, filmspotting.net, we do have a barn burner of a poll question going, though actually it's really tilted in one director's favor, which is usually the case for these death matches, though we often get some really nice 50-50 battles. But the question is simply, Scorsese or Tarantino, which movie-obsessed famously movie-obsessed director, would you choose to program your repertory movie theater? And we actually sort of, because I couldn't really pick a side, but we did sort of split on this last week. You very decisively went with Scorsese.
You were leaning towards a split.
I said, wow, Scorsese was the obvious answer. And then I really thought about it some more, and maybe Tarantino's not a bad choice.
And then my argument in favor of Scorsese drove you to Tarantino, apparently.
Probably. That is how it works sometimes here on Film Spotting. You can add your vote. You can share your comments. Please do tell us where you're from if you remember when you share that comment in the poll. And if you are at all confused about what a Film Spotting deathmatch is really all about, let's let Twitter handle camera_angel explain. Josh, do you want to recount this Twitter conversation we caught happening?
Yeah, so I guess someone blithely asked in response to the poll question, why not both?
Yeah, why do you have to choose?
Okay, so Camera Angel responded, that is not how Film Spotting polls work. One director has to die.
That sounds like a t-shirt for me. A Film Spotting sure. t-shirt. Let's get it into production. Thank you for that perfectly succinct explanation of our death matches. Again, you can vote now at filmspotting.net. Also at filmspotting.net, you can get ticket information for those of you who are based here in Chicago or nearby surroundings on September 30th. Josh, I think that is a Tuesday night. I think it's a Tuesday night, September 30th.
Okay.
I'm going to be participating along with two other critics in a Chicago International Film Festival event. They just unveiled the whole lineup for the October Festival. We're very excited about it. Hopefully we'll get a chance to check out some of these movies. And they're having a Critics Picks event, kind of a preview of the festival with myself, our friend Tasha Robinson from The Dissolve, and Matt Pace from The Red Eye here in Chicago. We are going to basically sit down and have a chat and share the movies that we're most excited about.
Very cool.
You can be part of that if you want. There's going to be drinks. There's going to be food. There's going to be talking. I'm not sure what else, but I'm looking forward to it. I hope to see some Film Spotting listeners there.
Another thing for you to prepare for.
Exactly.
Hey, your class is over.
My
right?
class is
so
over.
You're not doing anything.
I need something to fill the void, certainly. And you can get all that information, including how to get your tickets, just by going to filmspotting.net and look in the show notes. With that, we move on to Massacre Theater.
We perform a scene. You get a chance at winning a prize. Last week, we massacred this.
We'll save that guy for later.
My wife and I would like to ask you a couple of questions.
Sure. Go ahead, shoot.
Well, for instance, what are your qualifications?
Ah, well, I attended Juilliard. I'm a graduate of the Harvard Business School. I travel quite extensively. I lived through the Black Plague, and I had a pretty good time during that. I've seen The Exorcist about 167 times, and it keeps getting funnier every single time I see it! Not to mention the fact that you're talking to a dead guy! Now, what do you think? You think I'm qualified?
What I mean is, can you be scary?
Oh, I know what you're asking me. Can I be scary? What do you think of this? You like it?
That was Michael Keaton as Beetlejuice and Alec Baldwin as the recently deceased Adam Maitland in 1988's Beetlejuice. It was written by Michael McDowell and Warren Scarron and directed, of course, by Tim Burton. A couple of weeks back on episode 504, we looked ahead to the post-summer cinematic offerings with our fall movie preview, and we also had a review and some bonus content spoiler talk of the new film The One I Love with Mark Duplass and Elizabeth Moss. Plus, also in that episode, an interview with Dan Schechter, director of the new Elmore Leonard adaptation, Life of Crime. Wade Goodenberger of Rochester, Minnesota, helps explain the Beetlejuice connection.
Longtime listener Wade says, I'm guessing the connection is related to the anticipated Iñárritu film Birdman, starring Michael Keaton, Beetlejuice himself. Of course, Wade and most of our listeners were correct in guessing that. That was one of my most anticipated fall things, seeing Michael Keaton in a juicy lead role. Here's hoping Keaton has his own revival this year, Wade writes, a la the McConaissance of 2013. The Keetoration? Keetovery? Keetsurgence.
Keetovery, right? It's got to be Keetovery.
Keetovery?
Yeah.
They're all pretty terrible.
That just rolls off the tongue.
I love that he made the effort, though. That's really all that matters.
Nice try, Wade. We also heard from Julio Oliveira from Austin, Texas. Keaton plays Beetlejuice in Beetlejuice. He also plays Ray Nicolette in Out of Sight and Jackie Brown, both Elmore Leonard adaptations. I feel ridiculously smart, even though I know this was an easy one.
David Pate in Dover, Tennessee was one of maybe only two or three listeners that also caught a connection between Beetlejuice and The One I Love. That gets into some spoiler territory. If you've seen both films, though, we're not going to share it, during Massacre Theater, if you haven't seen The One I Love, but really just germane to the story of both films. There is something with both couples.
Okay.
In those films. And their surroundings. This is their going. Environment, we'll All say right. that. And David noted that you referenced Mars Attacks in that show, which is a Tim Burton film.
Wanted to give a little hint there.
You did that. And, of course, it took me looking at this just now to realize that Michael McDowell wrote Beetlejuice and Charlie McDowell, unrelated, directed The One I Love. So the connections just abound, Josh. In closing, we do need to feature a listener who is going to praise you rightfully for your wonderful performance as Beetlejuice.
That would be David Furry from Fairview Park, Ohio. I would like to praise Josh on his inspired take on Beetlejuice. This performance is certainly in the running for not only this calendar year, it ranks among the best film spotting has ever seen.
That's a bold statement.
Wow. Now, the question is this. What role can help bring Adam out of his, I'm hesitant to call it, a massacre theater slump? Here's a suggestion. Colonel Kurtz from Apocalypse Now.
Now, why, for me, does he go to an overweight guy in the jungle who thinks he's a god?
No.
I mean,
I wouldn't take it so personally.
No?
And I do have to defend you, as we talked about before this Massacre Theater, you get stuck with the straight man roles.
The straight man or the
Quite
woman.
A bit. The straight woman roles are what you exceptionally excel at.
We'll see that in this week's edition, too.
All right. Can't wait.
I was playing right in my wheelhouse there. If you want to hear me in my wheelhouse as Adam, appropriately, in that scene from Beetlejuice and Josh's great Michael Keaton impression, you can get that episode at filmspotting.net or subscribe to the podcast on iTunes. Josh, this was one of the most entered Massacre Theaters we've had in probably 2 years.
How about that?
I think it was your performance. I think it was the fact that this is a bit of a beloved movie. It was
pretty easy.
That's a pretty famous bit we did. I like it. We need to make these easier more often.
All right. We can go that route.
Reach in to the brimming film spotting hat and pick out this week's winner.
Out of all those entries, the winner is Melissa Mallett from Vienna, Virginia.
Congratulations, Melissa. Email feedback@filmspotting.net to claim your Film Spotting t-shirt.
Ta-tay-tee-toe-too.
No, no, Miss Lamont. Round tones, round tones. Now let me hear you read your line.
It is time for some more bad acting, and the name Massacre Theater may never be more appropriate. Not in terms of the style and the quality of our acting, but in terms of the content of this movie,
Josh. Of the film, yes, that's true.
So a little bit of a hint there for you.
I'm also getting some expert direction here in the script. I notice it says, in a creepy voice,
right,
for me. So
it's going to be a stretch for you, but go for it,
Josh. That's all I need.
Okay, you're going to start in a creepy voice. I'm going to give you the action, and action.
They're coming to get you, Barbara.
Stop it. You're ignorant.
They're coming for you, Barbara.
Stop it. You're acting like a child.
They're coming for you. Look, there comes one of them now.
He'll hear you.
Here he comes now. I'm getting out of here.
And scene.
Boy, you outdid yourself as the straight woman.
I tried to come back. I don't know if it was Kurtzian or not, but
yes,
David.
There was a little flair of Colonel Kurtz.
There is a lot
in
of
that
horror.
Young lady.
The horror. In this movie, we hope you identified it correctly. Email the movie's title along with your name and location to feedback@filmspotting.net. Your deadline is Monday, September 29th.
Hello.
Where were you this morning?
Well, Kevin had a friend, and last night I got lucky.
Well, you missed work, so not cool.
I was a little late. Lance understood.
You have to get your shit together, Milo.
That is a very interesting statement coming from you.
You know what?
What? Wow.
Well, this horror theme we've hit on is going to continue if in name only. The Skeleton Twins open last weekend, stars Bill Hader and Kristen Wiig. It was, Josh, one of my most anticipated fall things after we got the big releases out of the way. I love the trailer for this movie. Couldn't wait to see it. And I just came from it. And disclaimers and big neon signs. Not only did I just come from it, but I'm still obsessed with finishing my top five David Lynch scenes.
You are.
We're about to get there, and I still haven't picked a number five. So my
we're not going to wait any longer.
My
either.
Mind is elsewhere. Don't have a lot to say about this movie, but I know that you did write about it. And I also know that we had opposite reactions because I like this movie quite a bit.
Really?
I really did. It's always more interesting, though, to hear from someone who has put some thought into why they didn't like it. So why don't you run with it?
I like it less and less with each passing day,
really?
So I don't want to put more thought into it. I mean, it looked appealing to me, too, mostly for the cast, Bill Hader and Kristen Wiig. reuniting in a sense from their SNL days as this brother and sister, this deeply dysfunctional brother and sister, both in their own lives and in their relationship with each other. Haven't seen each other for 10 years, spoken in 10 years, right? When the movie starts, calamity brings them together. The brother ends up moving in with the sister. She's married to Luke Wilson.
Specifically, I think we can say suicide.
Do we want to say that?
Suicide. Yeah, it's the beginning of the film.
It is in the beginning of the film.
Suicide brings them together.
Yeah, and so I don't really consider it a spoiler, but I thought maybe we should talk around it. I'm glad we're not, though, because the movie started off with a parallel suicide sequence, and I just something rubbed me the wrong way about that. It just throwing us in there, and then I felt like it had set this level for dysfunctional drama that it kept trying to top. And the end result for me was that the more troubles that were thrown these characters' way, the less I felt like the movie believed in them. This was a really false film for me. Not an intent. I think the performances are very earnest. And I think the filmmakers, it's directed by Craig Johnson, he wrote the script with Mark Heyman, are interested in making this family dynamic film something that is both relatable and quite funny, using the comic talents of the performers. But things are piled on so much that none of the actual issues are given much time to breathe because we're constantly on to the next trauma. And in between, we get these comedic scenes of camaraderie between the brother and sister that the actors pull off to a degree.
I think they definitely
do. But they also feel false within the construct of the entire film. So just this movie just rung hollower and hollower and hollower the further I got away from it.
Yeah, that's interesting because I definitely didn't feel it. What I do agree with you on is that there comes a point, this happens with a lot of movies, this is kind of your complaint with the movie The One I Love as well. It starts to get a little plot heavy. Things start to happen. More melodrama, more drama anyway. It kind of piles on to a point. And I expected the whole boat to just tip over and sink. And it never did for me. And maybe that's because of the performances. Bill Hader here in a far more serious turn than we've seen from him. Kristen Wiig, I'd say the same thing as well. They both take away a lot of their normal go-to comedic tics. And I think are really genuine on screen in every way. And I think that's what made me buy in so much to this relationship. That opening scene, as we touched on, where the Bill Hader character tries to take his own life, in the same moment, his sister is thinking about taking hers. And there is a really funny and a disturbing way moment where the hospital calls to say, we've got your brother. He just tried to kill himself. And she doesn't say, oh, that's great. I'm so glad he's well. She actually looks down at her pills like, well, that just ruined my plan. You know, there's a selfishness to that that I think is really believable for these characters as we see the whole film play out. And that first scene, I think Luke Wilson here is very good. A guy who notoriously gets credit for being just really bland, and he is, but he's sort of playing that persona in being the perfect husband here to Kristen Wiig's character. And there's a scene when they're at dinner. It's Bill Hader's first night. Milo is his character. He's decided to come from L.A. and spend a little bit of time with her and try to reconnect. As you said, they haven't been together in 10 years or so. And they're at dinner, and I just love watching Bill Hader. He's across the table from them. And every time Lance says something more semi-ridiculous, not really, but to these really jaded characters,
right,
it is.
Right.
He's just watching his sister the whole time, then looking at Lance, then looking back at his sister. He keeps looking to her to give him some kind of cue that this is all a joke, right? And you're in on it just like I am, right?
Yeah.
And she doesn't. And that, too, is just one of those great, subtle acting moments that cues us as an audience into how connected they really are and how disconnected they are in this moment as well, because she's not returning those glances.
I was impressed by Hader. I think he gives the best performance in the film. And I think what he does is he often achieves that balance of wit and deep sadness in the same scene that I think the movie overall doesn't quite do as good of a job of holding in tension with each other. And Luke Wilson has some funny moments as well. Wiig, you know, she's an interesting actor because for a comedian, a very funny comedian, she has a really naturally sad face.
She does.
It's long.
There's a real vulnerability to her.
She has those eyes. And I think in this film, she uses that so much. It's almost, she dims her charismatic bulb too much for me, and almost becomes a blank in this film. You see a little bit of it in those scenes I was talking about with Hader, but again, those are disjointed in where they're placed in the structure of the narrative itself, I felt.
Mm-hmm.
So I was surprised because I've been waiting for her to deliver this really knockout dramatic role, because what I've seen, the flashes of it here and there, I fully think she's capable of it. For some reason, this time it doesn't quite work.
Well, I agree with you, but I think that really gets at her character. I think that's kind of the point of the film, is that her personality, her charisma, her sense of life is really dim.
She's a depressed character.
Yeah, sure. She is not only depressed, but she is an especially depressed character and a dimmer character when she's not with her brother. And I think that that only comes out then by extension when he's around. So that relationship really did work for me. And when we were highlighting the things we were looking forward to this fall, I joked about how, you know, there's a sing-along. What could go wrong with the sing-along?
Yeah.
But you know what, Josh? I think what the movie really says, and look, I still laughed at the sing-along. To its credit, I laughed at the same scenes in this movie that I laughed at in the trailer. Hmm. I knew they were coming, and I still laughed at them. So those performances for me were really working. Not that this movie's a laugh riot, but the moments that were funny did, for the most part, connect with me. But I do think that what the movie ultimately says is, unlike a lot of movies that we're used to with those sing-along moments, those sing-alongs don't really solve anything. I think that that feels genuine to me. It's a moment. You can come together, and guess what? When the moment's over, you wake up the next day, all of your problems haven't been washed away because you had that one moment of happiness and connection.
Okay, that's good. That's good. I completely agree with that. And I wish that I had felt the film believed that too. But to me, it seemed like those moments, those interjections of Hader and Wig getting to rekindle their youthful relationship and have fun together, those were meant to be breakthrough moments for the film.
Hmm.
And yet it would come back to another really low, tragic twist thrown in or revelation thrown in. Because I think what you're talking about, if there was a commitment to that, a conviction to that, that I felt all the way through, that these things, these Sundance moments, you know, you had said the trailer made it look very Sundancey, that these Sundance moments don't really work, then I think we might have been onto something special. And you obviously read it that way, so some folks might. But to me, I felt like the movie wanted us to believe in them. Mm.
Maybe this is a case where your thoughts on the film, as cursory as they were in this case, maybe influenced me on the film, too, because I didn't read your review and I haven't. But I did see your first impression sort of tweet about it, or maybe I saw it on Letterboxd. It happens sometimes. And you said something about what I came to realize from watching the film was something about the suicide and the way it uses suicide, and that being something that you felt like the movie didn't completely earn and it kind of went too often. Maybe because I knew that, I recognized early on that that was the thing that you thought it did, I was being hypersensitive to its depiction of it or treatment and how it used it. And I actually felt the opposite.
Hmm.
I really felt like, and I can't speak on the subject, I haven't been affected by it personally. I don't actually even know anyone who has directly. So who knows whether it got it, quote unquote, right or wrong. But in terms of the context of the film, I didn't feel like it went to that as something to give us an easy sort of psychology on these characters. And as soon as it dealt with it, there were consequences. It did deal with it in an honest, painful, dramatic way, and not just as sort of a plot device. It felt like that to me.
Yeah, and I think I counted, I'm positive there were four instances where it's used as a threat. Might have been five.
I think there were more.
And I just kind of feel...
The hint of a threat that seemed legitimate to those characters based on the beginning of the film.
I just felt like they had nowhere else to go. They came out of the gate with that. So the only way we're going to be able to wring more drama is to go to that again and threaten it again. And to me, it felt a little cheap.
Okay. I think it does ultimately come down to whether or not you really buy into the notion from that opening scene that they are truly troubled people.
Yeah.
You know, not just people who are kind of struggling with day-to-day life, but really need some help. And I felt that, and the movie obviously did work a little bit more for me. That is The Skeleton Twins. It is out now in limited release. If you've seen it, we want to know what you think. Tell us which one of us got it right or wrong. Feedback at filmspotting.net.
We'll return to the land of David Lynch next with lists of our favorite Lynch scenes. Cue up the Roy Orbison. The Film Spotting Top 5 is next. Stay with us.
A candy-colored clown they call the Sandman tiptoes to my room every night. just to sprinkle stardust and to whisper, go to sleep, everything is all right. I close my eyes, then I drift away.
Going to get to some quick thank yous and nice comments from our listeners here in a moment. But first, another sponsor, a brand new sponsor to Film Spotting, Varidesk. It's a height adjustable standing desk. It allows users to sit and stand throughout the workday. I've seen a few of these at WBEZ. I know it's catching on a little bit. People who just want to be up and moving a little bit more, better for your posture. I don't know. Is this something you want to try?
This is all the rage at the day job. Actually, yeah, we have a couple of these tall bistro tables, so some of us use that. Two people have actually built their own standing desk.
They're
so into it, so I'm going to have to tell them about this.
They don't need to build their own. They can go to Varidesk. It adjusts from sitting to standing in only 3 seconds. It ships fully assembled and is ready to use right out of the box, and there are four models to choose from for single and dual computer monitors.
If you want more information, visit Varidesk.com. That's spelled Varidesk.com.
Film Spotting listeners, of course, still the lifeblood of the show here. And we do have two new $5 a month donors. Aaron M. in Chicago, who says he first heard about us when he bought a ticket to the 500th episode at the Music Box. But since that extra strong dose of Film Spotting radiation, I've been hooked. He was one of those people who just sort of wandered in off the street.
Didn't get the lead jackets we were passing out to protect others.
Apparently not.
But oh, well, he's been radiated.
Love to hear that, Aaron. Also, Derek in Cobourg, Ontario, Canada.
I've been listening to the show since before it was Film Spotting and have made the odd one-off donation. But I owe you more for all the times you've kept me engaged and sane on the 8 to 12-hour drives I regularly have to make for work.
That sounds brutal.
Trucker, I'm assuming?
Maybe. You'd get a lot of good podcast listening in, as it sounds like Derek does, but that does sound rough. Stay safe out there, Derek. A new Silver Club donor, Mary Chris, sent us, Josh, a letter, a card, a handwritten nice card with the donation to our P.O. box. Included, I don't know why I'm admitting this on air, because you're not getting any. There was a box of Hawaiian chocolates.
Really?
Those may have already...
Are they? I was going to say, do they still exist?
Been eaten.
That's all right.
I do have
four kids.
You know
I'm not
big
on the chocolates.
No, I knew that. I actually thought of that. I said,
did you?
Josh isn't going to mind.
I'm opening
this right now. And I did, and they were delicious. So thank you, Mary Chris, who says, I've been a listener since 2006. I started your show in Baltimore and kept up with it in Hawaii and still listen back home in the San Francisco Bay Area. Here's to 500 more shows.
A note here from another donor, Josh from Alexandria, Virginia. First, thank you for a splendid podcast/radio show. I learned about it from Dana Stevens via the Slate Culture Gab Fest, and it makes my morning commute something to look forward to. No easy feat in Northern Virginia. Second, when I'm not listening to Film Spotting, I listen to Spotify and have been enjoying the soundtracks from Wes Anderson. It led me to think of a poll idea. Which director curates the best soundtracks? At first, I was trying to decide between Scorsese's rock and roll extravaganzas and Wes Anderson's eclectica. Then, of course, there's the Coen brothers with T-Bone Burnett. Who else might you throw in the mix? If I may, Scorsese is great, but I have a bone to pick. You never put songs by the same artist back-to-back on a mixtape you're making for a friend, let alone from the same album. Gimme Shelter and Monkey Man were in the same scene where Henry and Karen Hill are running from the helicopter in Goodfellas. That said, he still manages to make it work. P.S. I donated $18 in honor of my grandmother's annual birthday gift.
All right. Thank you, Josh, and thank you, Josh's grandmother, for that inspiration. I love the rule he's trying to come up with there to exclude Scorsese. It is true you don't often go back to back with the same artist, but Scorsese's pretty interested in the Rolling Stones. That's been common.
Can I make a suggestion?
Yeah.
One that I don't always go to bat for? Tarantino should be on this list, right?
Very good. You're right. Tarantino,
okay.
His nemesis now, his death match
nemesis.
Of course, should be on the list, but really, let's just say it. Whether people want to hear it or not, the right answer is Zach Braff. See, I'm not joking.
We still have to catch up with...
I love the Garden State soundtrack.
Wish you were here.
Wish I was here.
Yeah, that
we
one.
We clearly didn't see it. And you really wanted to.
I do want to. I still want to. Do
we
you?
We will catch up with it at some point. Other good answers, my actual go-to answer, Cameron Crowe. I mean,
yeah, that's
singles,
true.
Almost Famous, though some original music there, maybe not such a big fan of from Stillwater, but no, throughout his body of work, the Say Anything soundtrack, so much good stuff. And of course, Richard Linklater, Boyhood, that movie is filled with great music. So some options there, but an interesting poll that we might get to at some point down the road. Thank you, Josh, for that. And thank you to all of our Film Spotting donors. Film Spotting Streaming Video Unit is a bi-weekly podcast hosted by BuzzFeed's Allison Wilmore and Matt Singer of The Dissolve, focusing on the world of online movies.
More information at filmspottingsvu.com or subscribe to the show on iTunes.
Hey there, Film Spotting Original Recipe listeners. This is Matt Singer from Film Spotting Streaming Video Unit, and on our latest episode, Allison Wilmore and I review the British prison drama Startup.
And inspired by Startup, we're also recommending some other films about fathers and sons that you can rent or stream at home right now. Plus, we'll also teach you how to make a prison shiv out of common household items. For more movie recommendations and survival tips than you can handle, subscribe to the show in iTunes or go to filmspottingsvu.com.
This is Craig Brewer, the director of Black Snake Moan, and you're listening to Film Spotting.
We've met before, haven't we?
I don't think so. Where was it you think we met?
At your house, don't you remember?
No, no, I don't. Are you sure?
Of course. As a matter of fact, I'm there right now.
You're listening to Film Spotting, and a scene there to get us into our top five David Lynch scenes. On the appropriately creepy note, that's Robert Blake with Bill Pullman from Lynch's Lost Highway. And Aaron Fenn, a listener from Huntington Beach, California, wrote in and said, that's one of his nominees for favorite David Lynch scene. I don't think I understood what the phrase chills running down your spine truly meant until I heard Robert Blake's wide-eyed mystery man tell Pullman, I'm at your house right now. And not only that, then Bill Pullman calls his own house only to hear Robert Blake's unexplainable voice say through the receiver, I told you I was here. Aaron adds, eek. I agree. I don't love Lost Highway. I've only seen it once when it came out. I've been on the record many times saying that I badly need to revisit it, especially considering how much of a Lynch fan I am. But that scene did make my honorable mentions.
And don't you think every Lynch film, even Dune, which I didn't get to for this list, but wanted to, could have a scene that would be eligible and understandably so for this list?
That's a good point. And I think we also could have done not just scenes. We could have done favorite David Lynch shots.
Yeah, we talked about that. Images,
yeah,
right?
Images,
just an image.
Favorite David Lynch characters, most visceral moments we could have done, or even favorite David Lynch lines. My two nominees from Wild at Heart, Freddie Jones and that weird frog voice.
Pigeons spread diseases and mess up the place. You see that?
Pigeons spread diseases and mess up the place. And the dad, the straight-laced detective dad in blue velvet telling Jeffrey, yes, that's a human ear, all right. Those would have been my two.
The frog voice is almost a lyric Frank would come up with, isn't it? From the Fassbender film.
That's a good point. I do want to set you up with this question, Josh. And we've done quite a few of these types of tributes to directors and even a few actors. So maybe we've hashed this out. But as you approach this David Lynch list, did you think about your top five scenes in the context of your favorite? The ones that are most memorable that you love to go back and watch and rewatch? Or are they definitive? You think they are just prototypical Lynch at his best, or maybe not so much definitive, but they are characteristic. They do speak to something that maybe we only see in David Lynch.
So this was revealing to me because I like Lynch. I think I like just about all of his films. I don't hold him as high of esteem as you do. So for me, I looked back at some of these scenes and found things that were revealing to me about his work that I hadn't thought of before. So maybe a weird sort of criteria, but that's just how it started to fall out. Not having a chance to revisit everything in total, I watched a lot of the stuff that was available, a lot of the scenes that were suggested to us on social media, and just went with a few that made me realize, oh, that's interesting about this guy's work that I hadn't thought of before. My number five comes from a film that I did manage to watch in its entirety recently because it was another blind spotting film for me. In addition to Eraserhead, I had never seen The Elephant Man. And so my number five comes from that film. It is the scene I'm calling On Display for the Doctors.
He is English. He is 21 years of age. His name is John Merrick.
This is a movie that I do like quite a bit, but I would say it's not of a piece. There are some very clear surrealistic Lynch scenes and then some very clear traditional period piece scenes. But one of those that beautifully blends the two comes about 20 minutes in. And this is when Anthony Hopkins' surgeon, Treves, presents John Hurt's John Merrick, the Elephant Man, before a classroom full of colleagues. Now, the point here is to show how Treves' treatment of Merrick, though it's in the name of science, is really no better than the exploitative routine that Merrick was subjected to at the circus freak show. So the scene opens with this close-up of a laboratory spotlight that's exactly like a spotlight you'd see at the circus. I like how the scene closes on that spotlight as well. Really nice bookending effect there. We then cut to Treves, who orders Merrick to be wheeled in on this cart that has these curtains around it. So again, curtains being pulled back, just like some sort of performance. And then Treves goes on to describe his condition, talking about him as if he's not even there. He's talking to the audience. That's what really matters.
Now, I wish to draw your attention to the insidious conditions affecting this patient. Can you see over there? Note, if you will, the extreme enlargement of the skull, right upper limb, which is totally useless, the alarming curvature of the spine. And would you turn around, please?
Turn around, please.
There's also an interesting camera angle that Lynch returns to in this scene, and it's from behind that curtain cart so that we only see Merrick's deformed silhouette. And I don't think, you know, we've already seen him in the film in full. So I don't think Lynch is doing this to create suspense or to draw out our own voyeuristic impulses. I think it means to distance us from those gaping doctors and colleagues who are watching him, to put us more in Merrick's position than in theirs, because, you know, that's going to generate empathy. And I think that's really the central drive of the Elephant Man, is this sense of empathy.
So then, gentlemen, owing to this series of conditions, the congenital exostosis of the skull, extensive papillomatous growth, large pendulous masses in connection with the skin, the great enlargement of the right upper limb involving all the bones, the massive distortion of the head, and the extensive area covered by papillomatous growth, the patient has been called the Elephant Man. Thank you.
Without a doubt, a great film, one I just revisited in the past year or so, watched it with my oldest and was really blown away by it. Hadn't seen it since I was much younger. My number five is one that I seriously have been deliberating on for about 72 hours. I told you last week when you suggested top five Lynch scenes that it was a great top five, but I was going to take it so seriously that, like Jack Nance in Eraserhead, I was going to be probably paralyzed by doubt and fear.
That was your face the whole time?
Yes.
Just staring blankly, bewildered.
Staring at a list of options, just looking bewildered. And this number five, I just reserve the right to change every few days or so, Josh, even though it's going to be in perpetuity in this podcast form. I may have to change it on the website. And it's maybe not a favorite, but it is one that does get at the heart of Lynch, I think. It gets at something we talked about very specifically in the context of our discussion of Eraserhead. And it also features one of my favorite Lynch villains in a movie I really wanted to definitely represent on my list. The movie is Wild at Heart. The villain is Willem Dafoe's Bobby Peru.
Yeah. Oh.
Hey, pretty woman. Sailor here?
Oh, he's changing oil in our car.
Man, I gotta take a piss, Ben. Can I use your head?
Yeah, I guess.
I don't mean your head, head. I'm not gonna piss on your head, your hair and all. Just gonna piss in the toilet. Y'all take a listen. You hear a deep sound coming down from Bobby Peru.
And like many Lynch scenes, this is one of the reasons I did decide to go with it. It's really difficult to watch. It's not a fun scene. It's a challenge. It's a challenge to watch a character so loathsome on screen as Bobby Peru is. And I know Sam and Joe, our producers, will love the fact that I picked a scene for my number five with dialogue mainly consisting of a two-word phrase we can't play on radio. But if you know Wild at Heart, it's the only scene in the movie that takes place with Bobby and Lula, Laura Dern's character, alone in her hotel room. Sailor's not there. She and Nicolas Cage, they have stopped off in this sleepy little Texas town on their way to California, running from Lula's mother. And the night before, they meet this group of people hanging out where they're at. And Jack Nance actually is included. He's one of the men there talking about his dog, famously, in this scene from Wild at Heart. And they meet Bobby. When he comes across Lula in her room, he immediately starts going to some places he shouldn't go with someone he's just met, or really anybody for that matter, immediately crossing some boundaries.
You got the smell in this room of puke. You been puking, little girl? Huh? You sick? Pregnant?
You use the toilet, now you can go. It ain't none of your business what I do around here, that's for sure.
You know, I sure do like a woman with nice like yours who talks tough and looks like she can like a bunny. Can you like that, huh?
Again, not radio friendly, not family friendly, so I'll simply say that the crux of the scene is him coming on to her and her resisting him, and then through sheer force of will physically and then also through some seductive prowess, he gets her at the end of the scene to basically say, yeah, I want you, and then the kicker.
Someday, honey, I will, but I gotta get going.
Sing. Don't cry.
There is just this element in Lynch, runs throughout his films, but definitely in Eraserhead, of that creepy sexuality, this sort of fear of one's own sexuality. Someone like Bobby is in complete control of it and uses it against Lula in this scene. And to have that real creepiness and that real terror that you feel for her in that scene, and then have it end with something that actually does make you laugh. Lynch is one of the few filmmakers that can really pull that off.
I didn't think of this when I was watching the film earlier this year, but Defoe's playing with this quite a bit, actually, in Grand Budapest Hotel, isn't he, with his villain?
Similar.
There's some physical characteristics for sure. So, yeah, creepy guy, perfect for a Lynch film. My number four, I'm going to jump ahead from The Elephant Man to Mulholland Drive, and it's Rebecca Del Rio's performance at Club Silencio. This was another case of Lynch incorporating existing musical art into his movie Dreamscape. Del Rio had already recorded and had been performing her a cappella version of Crying, which was mostly made famous by Roy Orbison, well before Lynch had asked her to perform it for this scene. This is when the mystery women, Betty and Rita, played by Naomi Watts and Laura Harring, make a late-night visit to the Curious Nightclub, where they find Del Rio singing.
Luego anoche te vi, tu mano me tocó, y el saludo de tu voz.
What I love about this scene, it goes back to something we've been talking about, defying expectations, pulling the rug out from under us a little bit, specifically our expectations for a Lynch film. It's a fairly straightforward scene. I mean, there's not anything really odd about it at the beginning. It's a cappella Lynch, really, in a way. It's just a woman performing in this spotlight. She looks fairly normal, elaborate makeup, a cocktail dress. But other than that, it seems to be fairly routine. And the scene cuts between her performance and Watts and Herring watching from the audience as they're increasingly moved and brought to tears. And it goes on for almost 4 minutes. I mean, it's the full performance. And then just when we feel comfortable, at that point, Del Rio collapses, but her voice continues singing, not missing a beat. So she's lip syncing, we assume, but I think this is another one of those instances in Mulholland Drive where Lynch is making us wonder if what we're seeing is real, or what real even means in this story.
I love that scene. An honorable mention for me, for sure. My number four is the perfect chaser to the harsh shot that was Bobby Peru at number five. It's from Lynch's most sentimental and, yes, his straightest story, The Straight Story, based on the real-life tale of Alvin Straight, who rode his John Deere tractor from Iowa to Wisconsin, something like 240 miles, to see his estranged brother, who I think had just suffered a stroke and knew that he may not have many more opportunities to see him, and that was the only way he could go. No longer having a driver's license, got on that tractor. This scene is the one between Richard Farnsworth and Wiley Harker. They go down to one of the local watering holes, and Alvin says, I don't drink anymore, but I always like a change of scenery. He's just going to go to talk to the man. They sit at the bar, and as the other man takes a swig from, I believe it's a Miller Lite, Farnsworth explains how he couldn't drink enough when he got back from the war and eventually got sober. And the other man says a lot of men came back drinking hard, and that's all he really wants to divulge. And then Alvin says, everybody's trying to forget. I can see it in a man right away. And there's this silence. And Wiley Harker just turns and looks at him quickly when he says, I can see it in a man right away, and then quickly looks back at his drink. And he takes that in for a second. He knows that it's sort of an indictment, a tacit indictment of him. And what he recognizes is that in that moment when he's saying, I can see it in a man, well, Alvin can probably see it in him, that he's one of those people. And rather than hide it, he's actually going to open up to him. And he does. The floodgates open. He recounts a story, a horrific story from his time in the war.
There was one time when we just were waiting for the first warm meal in 10 days. We thought we'd seen the worst. We hadn't had much trouble from the air. I was on the rise. It was the quartermaster working on more coffee for me and my buddies. A stray Focke-Wulf came over the treetops and dropped an incendiary in the mess tent. All my buddies. The crowd then banked right in front of me on that hill. And I can see the swastika.
What I love about this scene, not only the performances and just the emotion of it, but there's really no suggestion that the Harker character has a drinking problem or that Alvin is proselytizing to him, trying to get him to change in some way. There's just an inherent openness and honesty and vulnerability to that Alvin character. And he wants to let others in, and he wants others to have that same kind of openness. I also think it is obviously one of the themes of that movie, reckoning with the past and finding a way to move on from it. You have to be able to do that. And we see Alvin do that finally with his brother in another great scene, the closing scene with Harry Dean Stanton.
I'm glad you found a place for the straight story, because I know it got a lot of attention when it came out, but now I feel like it's sort of seen as this diversion Lynch did, when I think it really is one of his best films. My number three comes from a film you already mentioned, Wild at Heart, and it's The Desert Dance Party. I think Wild at Heart came out in 1991. It doesn't really get as much love among Lynch fans. Some actively dislike it, but I've always appreciated it for its use of music and its Nicolas Cage-iness.
Oh, yeah.
I mean, such great stuff. He's really in his prime here as Sailor. This is partly a road movie, and the scene I'm thinking of does take place on the road. Sailor's sleeping in the back seat of the convertible, and Lula's trying to find something on the radio.
For her recent divorce, shot and killed her three children, age 7. Shot right between heinous.
A local judge praised defendant John Roy, but was dismayed to learn that Roy had had sex with the corpse.
What?
Roy's lawyer was quoted as saying,
every station she tunes into has some horrible, horrible news report going on. It's terrible and quite comic. It's about corpses. It's about gunshot wounds, deviant sex. Not coincidentally, the sort of things that make up your average David Lynch movie.
Good point.
And she can't take it. She pulls over, wakes Sailor up, and demands he find some music this instant. So he tunes in to some sort of death metal, it sounds like. They both let out these primal screams and start kickboxing slash dancing like maniacs. I love Cage's touch, how he does the head flip out of the convertible.
Right.
You know, just he just woke up 5 seconds later, but he's there. He's into it. I think this scene is something of a retort to the sort of prurient material that Lynch's films often indulge in.
Yeah.
In a way, in this movie, Sailor and Lula are trying to flee from that awful world, and they frequently escape through music. The camera work here also supports this idea of setting them apart from so many of Lynch's characters. When Lula pulls over, he cuts to a full shot of the car, but then a crane gradually lifts above them. And then by the time they embrace at the end of their dancing, we've pulled back high enough and far enough that the sunset starts to seep in.
It's kind
to
of
the
a
top
classic Hollywood moment.
Very
There's
classic.
A real majesty to it. Yeah.
Even the death metal gives way to this classic Hollywood soundtrack music. So I think that for all the disturbing elements in his films, I get the sense, at least here, that he also believes in moments like this, just
a
little bit.
Yeah, without a doubt. And I think that that whole conflict between light and dark, that scene really captures it most directly in Wild at Heart, but it does run throughout his films. We'll get to a little bit more of it here in a couple picks. My number three is from Mulholland Drive, and I should point out that I forced myself not to have any overlap. Just with so many films I do enjoy and so many great scenes, I figured, come on, you can come up with five where you're not picking from the same movie. Otherwise, I may have had three or four from Mulholland Drive because I just do love that film so much. The one I'm going with at number three here is Betty's audition scene. Naomi Watts with Chad Everett. And this is something you brought up a couple weeks ago in talking about the new movie The Congress with Robin Wright, how there's a scene where she has to perform.
Yes.
She has to act, right? And I haven't seen it, but you felt like she didn't really completely pull it off.
This is that scene. This is Mulholland Drive,
right?
And Watts nails it.
I think she does. And I'll also point to another acting scene in a movie I love, Get Shorty, the scene where John Travolta is teaching this great actor, Danny DeVito's character, how to act properly.
Yeah.
He's telling him, look at me, right? DeVito in that scene, it's a tightrope because he has to act really badly. And he then has to turn and act really well. And both acting badly and acting really well on screen requires good acting. And so I always pay attention when that scene comes on to see how DeVito navigates that. And he always nails it. But it's tough. It draws the viewer's attention to the fact that this is a construct, that we are watching a performance here, a performance within a performance. So they really have to deliver if the whole point of the scene is that something magical is happening, that they've tapped into something, that they've connected in some way. And we certainly get that with what Naomi Watts and Chad Everett do. This is where we see the Betty character do a scene. We've already heard her rehearse with Rita in their little bungalow or whatever, and it's horrible. It's completely melodramatic. She plays it exactly as it seems to be written, and it really sounds like terrible TV soap opera acting. So you have no faith that when she actually gets into that room that something is going to happen and she's going to get to the heart of the scene. But she doesn't play it as melodrama in that moment. She hits it as drama. She plays it not as a victim. A little bit of a very sly spoiler alert here. The victim, I think she sees herself as in real life, but she's the person controlling the scene. She dictates the action. She dictates the sexuality. She dictates all the tension.
You're playing a dangerous game here. If you're trying to blackmail me, it's not gonna work.
You know what I want. It's not that difficult.
Get out before I call my dad. He trusts you. You're his best friend.
It's not just good acting, Josh. I think it's almost as if that Betty character has been taken over by one of those sinister forces that David Lynch likes to play with and suggest to us that they're out there. They're especially out there in Hollywood. She becomes a different person entirely in that scene. And then I love how she just snaps back out of it at the end, back to Betty, as if it has been almost a spell she's been under. And that transformation that we see her undergo there suggests that maybe she's just as dark, if not darker and more mysterious than Rita, who has been the mystery girl up to this point. It's a great scene. I know you really like it too, Josh, because you've been begging for us to do it in Massacre Theater for a long time, and I'm just not comfortable enough yet to go there. Maybe someday.
That's your young woman. That's the young woman you've been practicing for.
Yeah.
Naomi Watts and Mulholland Drive.
Mulholland Drive, though, that whole movie is such a rich deconstruction of the Hollywood myth, a myth that keeps young Betty's coming fresh off the bus or fresh off the plane to Hollywood to this day, and that scene is really a key cog in that myth deconstruction.
I'm glad you mentioned Chad Everett too, who's her co-star in the scene in a couple of senses, because he's really good as
when
you think about what he has to do. He has to be this kind of generic stiff soap opera actor who gets caught off guard during the audition, yet he stays in the scene with her.
Yeah, there's no reason to believe that at the beginning he's going to be able to run with her,
right?
Because he's just as cheesy and melodramatic as Betty was previously.
But then he does, and it becomes something really special.
Yeah.
So you were talking about light and dark. My number two comes from maybe his filmography's darkest place. It feels like that to me. It's Blue Velvet. And tons of suggestions came in when we asked for nominations for this Lynch Scenes Top 5 suggestions for Dennis Hopper's Frank Booth. He's such a crazed, terrifying force in this 1986 Bizarro Noir. People had all different scenes they wanted to see. He's the deranged criminal who has kidnapped nightclub singer Dorothy Valens, played by Isabella Rossellini, and Kyle MacLachlan plays the all-American kid who gets sucked into his world. The scene that I'm thinking of, I considered a number of them. You know, his early attack on Rossellini, which MacLachlan witnesses while hiding in the closet. There's his profane defense of Pabst Blue Ribbon over Heineken, another example of Lynch humor. But I went with a car ride where Booth takes MacLachlan, Rossellini, and a couple of henchmen along, and he and MacLachlan have this confrontation there.
What are you looking at? Nothing. Don't you look at me, like me.
Blue Velvet, when it came out, received some criticism, famously from Roger Ebert and others, for its use of violence, especially that directed toward Rossellini. But I think this scene is revealing about the purpose of the Booth character. He pulls over the car and he demands of MacLachlan, who's in the back seat, "What are you looking at?" And this also gets into one of the things I love about Blue Velvet is the idea of voyeurism and the rear window element going on here and the implicating of us in the audience. Then after asking MacLachlan that question and after taking one of his really elaborate drags on the gas mask that Hopper just pulls out so beautifully, he blatantly states, "You're like me."
Mm-hmm.
And, you know, this really gets at the heart of Blue Velvet for
Because he's hurting her and Jeffrey doesn't look away, right?
He's watching. He's the watcher. He's us, right, in that scene. And I think that much of this movie is trying to bridge that gap between this clean-cut kid and this criminal. I mean, if Blue Velvet is partly about the seedy underbelly of supposedly squeaky clean suburbs, we have the famous opening shot that goes under the lawn to reveal the bugs, then this is suggesting, you know, we all, too, are corrupted underneath. Not just Frank, the guy who flaunts his corrupted nature, but MacLachlan's good kid, too.
Mm-hmm.
I mean, I'd almost say that the scene is too on the nose with dialogue like that, except that right after this moment, we get Frank smearing lipstick on his face, lip-syncing words to Roy Orbison's In Dreams, and threatening MacLachlan with a knife, and all this while a prostitute is doing a slow dance on the roof of the car. So it's on the nose, maybe, but it has a distinctly Lynchian flair,
too. Yeah, on the nose for Lynch.
Exactly.
Which you do have to make that distinction. Obviously a great scene, and you're right. Any scene with Frank Booth from Blue Velvet probably should have been considered for this list. My number two comes from a movie you've previously mentioned. It is The Elephant Man, and I love this film, so this was hard, but there is one scene for me that emerges as my favorite, and it's certainly the most emotional. It's one of the scenes, maybe in all of cinema, that slays me the most. I did truly, and I'm not one of these people who gets highly emotional watching movies, but just rewatching this scene today for this list, it got a little dusty at the computer taking a look at it. And it's the scene between John Merrick, the Elephant Man, and Treves, Anthony Hopkins, and Treves' wife on his visit to their house. And I love how he asks where their children are, and she gives this furtive glance because she's a little embarrassed and feels shame. And Treves says, "Oh, they're playing with friends." Not quite ready to show them John Merrick just yet, but he meets Treves' wife, played so wonderfully by Hannah Gordon. They're looking at the photos of their kids, then Treves' mom, and that prompts Merrick to show them a picture of his mother.
"Mr. Merrick, she's beautiful."
"Oh, she had the face of an angel. It's been a great disappointment, John."
"No, Mr. Merrick, no, no. No son as loving as you could ever be a disappointment."
"If only I could find her, so she could see me. We're just lovely friends here now. Perhaps she could love me as I am. I'm trying so hard to be good."
Here is a man born horribly disfigured, had no choice in the matter. That's just the way he was made. Against his will, forced into performing as a freak, treated unspeakably badly. He's truly a victim, but he feels guilty of letting his mother down, as if he did something wrong to force her away. And that line, "I've tried so hard to be good," the sad kind of optimism in that, his notion that if he was just a little bit better of a person, maybe people wouldn't be so scared of him. Maybe his mom would be proud to see him. And he says it, that's emotion enough. And then watching Hannah Gordon lose it in that scene, that's where then the floodgates open. And like I said, that scene just annihilates me. And it's not a flashy scene, but it doesn't need to be.
No, and she's so good because normally you don't need or necessarily want the other character in the scene to be showing the emotions you should be feeling, right? Because that piles it on.
Mm-hmm.
But for some reason, it is so genuine, her response, and I think it's also tied into what you talked about, the fact that the kids aren't there. Like, all of a sudden she's realizing this is someone the kids should know because he's such a fundamentally decent human being. And her kind of complicated feelings with what her husband's doing with him, the husband's complicated feelings, it's all tied up into her response there.
It is. And it's another movie, The Elephant Man, like Eraserhead, obviously shot in black and white, though not quite the high contrast that you get in the 1977 film. It's another movie that captures the terrible depravity and the darkness in humanity, but you also get in this film what makes it palatable, and I don't mean that in any kind of condescending way. It's a good thing because we see a lot of horror. We get the dignity and we get light. I really think the worst and the best of humanity are on display in The Elephant Man.
That scene also, I think, points to the straight story in a lot of ways because it's a very straight scene, right? It's completely on the surface. Take it for what it's worth, and it works really well, as much of the straight story does. All right, we're down to our number one scenes, and I save that slot for one from my favorite Lynch film. It's Eraserhead, The Chicken Dinner. This occurs early on after Jack Nance's Henry Spencer has been invited for dinner at the house of his girlfriend's parents. And they're serving these tiny baked birds. I don't know if they're chickens or quail or something oddly in between.
Can I just say that you're scaring me right now?
I know.
This is your number one. You're really scaring me.
Oh, because I chose that?
Yeah.
Hey, confront your fears, Adam.
I guess.
Mary X's father asks Henry if he'd carve them. And here's the kicker. Why? Because the father's afraid to. Okay, not being polite, but yeah, where's this going to go? So as soon as he touches the carcass with a fork, the legs start moving. This thick, dark goo spills out. I think we get it twice, a horrifying close-up of these bubbles. And it's almost like something from early Buñuel. It's so jarring and off-putting, and you're trying to make sense of it.
And it foreshadows something similar we're going to see later.
It does. And this is just another hint that, you know, the movie, as we talked about a little bit, is more about this fear of fatherhood or domesticity. It's fundamentally this exploration of social anxiety using such jarring images. And I count this one as one of the most jarring images in the film, at least it is for me. We also talked about the comedy in our review and so many funny touches here. I mean, the fact that the bird's so tiny and the knife he's handed is so enormous, ridiculously huge. We have Jack Nance's dazed expression that we've discussed. Even he keeps it. I don't know how he managed to do this. After Mary X's mother starts like
convulsing
her tongue.
Yeah, it's really
like,
weird.
She's excited at first and then it turns into this seizure.
Yeah, like she's having a seizure.
And she and the daughter have to get up and leave the room. And he just sits there with the father in bewilderment. He really is, like I said, the straight man to this absurdist comedy, plays the part perfectly and makes this scene work.
Well, I'm not sure I can top The Chicken Dinner from Eraserhead, but I'm going to go for my number one with a movie you had at number two. Cue up the Bobby Vinton.
She wore blue velvet, bluer than velvet was the night.
Blue velvet, and as many good options as there are, for me, it's all about the opening scene. Those blue velvet curtains, the credits. We go from that to the song, That beautiful blue sky, roses in front of a white picket fence, red, white, and blue, very American there, right in the shot, of course. The Lumberton firemen go by. They wave to us, which I love that Lynchian touch of them waving to the camera there. That's how
we're voyeurs.
It is, yeah, and we are. More flowers, yellow flowers, and a fence, kids at a crosswalk. Then we get a house with one of those white picket fences and an old man watering his lawn. His wife inside watching a detective mystery on TV because, of course, it's only on TV that people like that would see something so nefarious happening. They have to see it from the comfort of their living room. Back to the old man. There's a snag in the hose. He clutches himself, has some kind of heart attack, and he falls to the ground. And the hose begins spraying wildly. A dog barks and drinks from the hose. The hose up, I will note, in a very phallic fashion. Cut to a close-up of the dog's mouth, slow motion now, biting at the water. And this idyllic setting, for a minute, has become much darker and sadder and violent. We continue to hear the sound of the water. The camera glides along and goes down into the grass to reveal a severed ear teeming with insects. The whole movie that follows, of course, is the story behind how that ear got there. And I think that two-minute sequence sets up that light and dark battle that underscores the whole movie and much of Lynch's work. Why are there people like Frank? That's the question Jeffrey has to ask at one point and has no answer. There always have been and always will be people like Frank. And it took their discovery of this ear to have their eyes open to it, to want to actually look into it and investigate it. They got the look under the surface that Lynch shows us in the beginning. And it's ugly and disturbing. It's a little bit, maybe, Josh, looking back on it now, almost 30 years later, to use your phrase, talking about another scene from Blue Velvet, a little bit too on the nose. It seems maybe a little too ironically quaint in the way that Lynch presents scenes sometimes, but I just go back to seeing it for the first time after the movie came out around 90 or 91 when I was 17 or 18 years old, and it was a game changer for me. I've said it on the show many times. It was absurd and weird and poetic in a way that at that point I hadn't seen from cinema. So with a little bit of a nostalgic nod to it, but I still think the scene holds up absolutely. That sequence, the opening sequence from Blue Velvet's my number one.
Yeah, I mean, you're looking at it in retrospect and it was a shockwave. It wasn't obvious at all to have a movie open this way, deeply subversive, not only within its own story, but within what we were getting in 1986.
That's it.
I mean, it had been the high point of the studio production factory phase. We've had many of those phases, let's be honest. But in 86, we were at one of the high points. And here you have something that turns that on its head and is eager to make its audiences uncomfortable.
Yeah, make them squirm a little bit. And you're certainly right that since then, we've seen so many movies give us the darkness beneath the surface of suburbia. But I don't know that we've ever seen it quite like Lynch, and I don't know that we had it in our face that way before 1986 and Blue Velvet. Those are our top five David Lynch scenes. What about any honorable mentions for you, Josh?
Well, this just shows how rich of a field it was, because I don't think any of these that I have here have come up. The brothers sitting together on the porch at the end of the street story, I think you referred to it, didn't pick it.
Mm-hmm.
But Melissa Taminga from the Film Spotting Advisory Board suggested that one. I would definitely agree with the monster behind the diner in Mulholland Drive. Another Mulholland Drive scene that we referenced at the start of the show, the cowboy. And then an iconic scene from The Elephant Man would be the I'm not an animal.
Yeah.
Which he shouts out tellingly while falling down beneath the mob amidst urinals. Really powerful moment.
It is, and a great place to start for my honorable mentions. I had I Am a Human Being, and also the one I referenced during our Eraserhead review, This Is My Home, that sequence with Treves and John Gielgud. From Blue Velvet, The Candy-Colored Clown, Joyride with Frank that you had, Josh, and Baby Wants Blue Velvet, another one you did mention there, that opening, just horrifying sequence where we see through Jeffrey Beaumont's eyes what is happening between Isabella Rossellini and Dennis Hopper. Wild at Heart, the Don't Turn Away from Love ending, I like a lot. And also a scene I mentioned a while back in our top five dance scenes that are not in dance movies. That first dance scene to the heavy metal with Lula and Sailor. Mm-hmm. And then he stops to defend his girl's honor. And I love how he throws his cigarette down on the ground. And then he takes the guy and puts him down on the ground. And his hand, of course, hits right in the spot where the cigarette is, as if he had it planned there all along. Mulholland Drive, I love the whole Club Silencio sequence in Llorando that you mentioned. And This Is the Girl, Every Little Star scene, that scene where the director has to pick the girl he doesn't want to pick, those unseen forces now seen, representing the unseen forces, mm-hmm. making sure that he picks the right girl. But then he makes that connection as well visually with Naomi Watts as Betty. I've got a couple others we've already talked about. I'll close with Fire Walk With Me. I can't single out Twin Peaks, even though I adore it, because it's television and not movies. And
I was wondering if you might break that rule.
This is not Nom. There are rules,
okay,
Josh. But Fire Walk With Me, a certain someone, for those who haven't seen it, in Laura Palmer's room, still a terrifying, terrifying moment for me. So a lot of honorable mentions, and I think we could go on and on, but we will close there. Send us your picks or any other comments about the show to feedback@filmspotting.net.
You can also leave us voicemail, 312-264-0744, or find us on Twitter at Filmspotting and at facebook.com/filmspotting.
Out in wide release this weekend, The Maze Runner, another young adult adaptation.
Wait a minute, let me guess.
Another one,
is
yeah.
Is it set post-apocalypse?
Wow. How did you guess that, Josh? This is where I leave you out as well, a comedy about a dysfunctional Jewish family who are forced to sit together for 7 days. I think that was their dying father's wish, and I'm sure we're going to get some really Sundance-y moments. I want to see This Is Where I Leave You, though it's not probably one we're going to get to discuss here on the show. It stars Rose Byrne, Jason Bateman, Tina Fey, Jane Fonda, among others. Tusk, the latest from Kevin Smith, opens, and A Walk Among the Tombstones, a thriller from writer-director Scott Frank. It stars Liam Neeson. Out in limited release, one of my most anticipated films of the fall, The Disappearance of Eleanor Rigby with Jessica Chastain and James McAvoy, and also The Zero Theorem, the latest movie from Terry Gilliam. You recommended it, Josh, a few episodes back. That's opening theatrically now.
Yeah, and I'd say it's worth seeing in the theater. Some really strong production design, as there always is in Gilliam's films, mm-hmm. but it looks really good in this one.
Next week, I will be off. Michael Phillips sitting in for me. And I guess if you want to know what happens when I take a week off from the show, as you put it in an email exchange earlier today, Josh, a three-letter word happens. A three-letter word that starts with F happens when I step away from the show.
What's that?
Fun. Fun happens. As Josh and Michael will be reviewing not The Disappearance of Eleanor Rigby, but the Kevin Smith movie Tusk, which I'm curious about.
Yeah.
And why don't you go ahead and share the top five?
Well,
because I can't say it with a straight face, but you go ahead.
Related to Tusk, which has something to do with a walrus man.
Just say it.
From what we understand.
Just say it.
Obviously, you go with top five movie Manimals. I mean,
obviously,
we've all been waiting for this opportunity. Here it is in our laps. And you said, what was your problem with it?
I don't have a problem with it.
No, something about, obviously, there's not as much richness as some of the other options that had richness. You were going for richness. I would agree. Not a lot of richness in movie Manimals, but what is there? What is there?
There is,
F-U-N.
The letter word, fun. It is hard to believe it only took 506 episodes to get to Manimals, but here we are.
I've been wondering what took you guys so long. Film Spotting is produced by Golden Joe Dassault and Sam Van Halgren. Without Sam and Golden Joe, this show wouldn't go. Thanks to associate producer Candace Griffiths and the listeners of the Film Spotting Advisory Board. And special thanks to everyone at Chicago Public Media. Chicago Public Media creates award-winning content about the issues that affect our community, our nation, and our world. More information is available at chicagopublicmedia.org. For Film Spotting, I'm Josh Larson.
And I'm Adam Kempinar. Thanks for listening.
This conversation can serve no purpose anymore. Goodbye.
First of all, to be clear, I do know the difference between the two actors. I do know that James Coburn was in Affliction.
Yes.
And I know that Lee Marvin was our man Flint. Discussed on the show, he was the Dirty Dozen. Okay, I know.
I believe you.
But here's the thing.